Cool. So is everybody ready?
All ready to go.
Yeah.
All right. Let me take me another hit of the coffee.
Yeah. Had to do it too. Some of the juice.
Yes. And all right, cool. So on the countdown of three, we'll just all clap. Doesn't have to be exact. Just gets me in the general ballpark. So in 3, 2, 1. Perfect.
Oh, all right. Okay. Cool.
It sounded way off to me. I don't know, man. You the boss, man.
I'll take it as a win. Yes.
You the boss.
All right. Hello, people, and welcome back to Street PX, a photography podcast. It is Tuesday, March 13th, and you're listening to Casper.
And Jim Watkins. How you doing, Casper?
I'm doing great and really excited for this show. We have LA's photographer, Robert LeBlanc, skateboarder, photographer, man of exploration.
Oh, Mark, you can say that again, man.
Oh, dude, we get down some really interesting paths on this when we talk about his trip to Bulgaria, the skateboarding culture and how it and videography and photography relate. That was a cool talk.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a question I've always kind of been interested in. What makes the skateboarder want to pull the camera out?
And he lets us know it's fascinating.
Yeah, yeah. But before we get into all of that, we do have a couple of plugs. First one is for, well, actually, both of these are for our international listeners out there. This was sent in to me by a listener of the show, Andre Bellatini, and he was telling us about in Ravenna, Italy. Alex Maioli, director of Magnum, has an exhibit coming to the Ravenna Art Museum. That's on April 15 through June 17. So it's coming up quick, and you don't want to miss that. It's going to be a really great show by an amazing photographer. And Jim, I know you got...
For me, there's a friend of the show and also a dear friend of mine, Rosa Wolf, is having an exhibit at the Leica store in Rome. It's going to run from April 10th to May 10th, and it's called Floating World. And if you've seen her work, it is outstanding. I think the opening reception will be on April 10th, is running from 7:30 to 9:30 p.m. So you guys in Rome, who live in Rome, around Rome, will be in Rome anytime between April 10th and May 10th. Don't miss that show at the Leica store in Rome.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Good shout out there to Rosa.
Yeah.
Yes. So that's our plugs for today. And like I said, all international. But we do want to give some love to our sponsor, Glass Key Photo. That's San Francisco's premier location for all things analog. If you're looking for a camera, you're looking for film, both new or freaky. If you want to check out some wonderful zines made by artists right here in the Bay Area, this is the place to go. Open from 12 to 6, 7 days a week. And it's owned and operated by Matt and Gordon. And this is a place you don't want to miss when you're in San Francisco. They also have a wonderful event coming up called Photo Gods. That's a zine fair. So again, for you zine fans out there, that's on March 24th right there at their location. Again, that's at 1230 Sutter Street. I hopefully I'll get back from my trip in time to be able to visit that.
How about I'll cover for you, buddy, if you're not there, man.
I appreciate
it. I'll represent.
And one last thing I do want to note is I have a workshop coming up in April myself. That's actually going to be down in Mexico, Querétaro, Mexico. And a friend of mine and wonderful photographer down there and writer, Ricardo Garcia, is going to be helping. And more information of this can be found over at my website, recasper.com. It's a 3-day workshop from April 10 through April 12. And we're going to be doing a lot of fun things together. And we are also going to try and produce a zine from our workshop. So that's kind of a funny hand-in-hand with the Glass Key Photo event, huh?
Yeah, exactly. Man, I can't wait to see the zine that you guys produce, man.
Yeah, I think that'd be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Last but not least, if you are enjoying our show, definitely go take a look at patreon.com/streetpx. And you can give a buck, give $5, whatever it is, or go check out our merchandise store. The link's over at streetpx.com. Pick up a t-shirt. All that money goes back into helping us keep this show and make this show as good as it can possibly be. So enough with all of that. Let's go ahead and get into our interview with Robert LeBlanc. And that starts now. First thing I want to kind of start out with is you're based in LA, right?
Yeah.
Excellent. But you're not LA native. You came there through Montana?
Yep. Born and raised in Montana in a small little logging town, kind of in the northwest corner, pretty much right on the Canadian border. So.
Oh, man.
Logging town, huh?
Yeah. Very tiny little town.
You want to give it a shout out?
Yeah, shout out to Eureka, Montana, for sure. Okay, all 2,000 right. people that live there.
Oh, man, a metropolis, huh?
Oh, major. Crazy.
Huge. I know the feeling of a rural town. We had about 2,000 for my county. So.
Oh, there you go. All right, so you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
I think like our high school, our graduating class was about 70 people. Like,
ooh,
it's
okay.
tiny.
Yeah.
So it was the teachers taught you and your parents.
Yeah, pretty much. Actually, my grandfather was the principal there for many, many years. So actually, my family taught the majority of the town.
Oh, so, right,
so everybody knows everybody's business and reputations are established well before you actually enter the high school.
Oh, definitely. There's no secrets there whatsoever.
Oh, man.
That was one thing I learned about where I grew up. When you have an older brother, especially one as wild as mine was, it's like by the time you get to high school, you're already ruined.
Oh, yeah. Luckily, I'm the older one, so my younger brother got screwed on that process.
Oh, sure. Yeah. So what's your story? What's your migration story? How'd you get from Montana to LA?
Right out of high school, I literally like the day after I graduated, I went down to Seattle. And then I was in Seattle for probably about 6 years and then ended up making a lot of good friends there. I was doing a lot of work down in LA back and forth from Seattle. And then eventually I decided I needed to make the move. I was sick of the rain. I needed a change of pace. And LA was a better place to kind of focus my attention on, at least for photography. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Right on. 6 years in Seattle. It is a different kind of rain up there, isn't it?
Oh, God. It's every fucking day.
It's just misty.
Yeah. At first it's like, all right, cool, it's a new place, you get used to it. But after a couple of years, you're just like, no, I can't do this. 100 plus days of rain every day, it won't happen.
I feel depression coming in.
Yeah, right? Oh, God, it just like sits on your shoulders. It's horrible.
Now, while you were in Seattle, just before we move back to the LA thing, you were in Seattle, were you doing photography then? Or did it start in Montana? Or was this kind of a late in life or kind of change?
Well, photography's always been around. Even since I was a little kid, my first camera was gifted from my father. It was one of his old Nikons from when he was in from his teens. So that's kind of how I caught the bug. For being such a small town, they actually had a photography class. So it was really cool. Oh. So yeah, I got to play around in the dark room a lot and kind of really dive into that when I was probably in my, 14, 15.
Oh, nice.
And then it always was part of me when I skated. You know, skateboarding is such a huge part of my life and it's influenced me with everything. So whenever we were out skating, in the middle of the night, all over the place, I always had a little camera on me. It was usually a disposable camera until I ended up getting a nice one down the road. But yeah, photography has always been a part of me from day one.
Nice.
So I went to Seattle and I was kind of doing the snowboard skateboard thing for a while. And then I blew out both of my knees.
Oh.
So after my second ACL tear, it was kind of like, all right, now it's time to really focus 100% on taking photos. You know, I knew that the life of jumping up and down things was to its end. So I had to come up with a backup route.
Just out of curiosity, as far as that injury, did that happen during a gnarly trick or was it just like, oh, I fucked up?
Combination of both, for sure. The first one was just I was skating and I landed really bad on a transition and it just blew out my knee right there. So I got that fixed quite quickly. And then the second one, I kind of tore skating and then I completely blew it out snowboarding. I overshot a jump, went like an extra 30 feet than I should have right to flat and just boom, blew it out right there. And then,
my God.
So, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. A little too much energy on that liftoff, right?
Oh, Jesus. That was a horrible day too because we were hitting this jump all day and it was kind of sunny. So it was a little slushy and slow. So I was like, all right, I kept going higher and higher and just pointing at trying to clear this landing. And then the last ride up, the clouds came over and got a little cold and it kind of iced everything over on the chairlift run. So then I was like, I'm going to start up way higher. And then completely not paying attention to the weather and like the conditions. And then I just like overshot it, landed all the way down the flat.
Oh my God.
So you hear that, people? One little error, one misjudgment, and you're 30 feet past your landing zone.
Yeah, a couple fucking clouds. That's all you need.
I'm an old time skier. You know the how people used to do it on two boards. You know.
Yeah.
And man, I've done that. I've done that before. Oh my God. I haven't blown out my knees, thank God. But I have misjudged things and wound up on my head at one point. Man, that's
God. Yeah, there's a few times for that, for sure. Yeah.
See, Jim, you got your injuries from, you know, tackling and running through
playing football, and then softball after the years of softball. Yeah, so that's me.
Oh, yeah. Softball is dangerous, man.
So you got to watch out. Well, I mean, that's the life of sports, right? It's almost inevitable. Like, enough wear and tear in your body, it's going to end up affecting you at some point.
But you know, the great thing about you, you had a camera a lot of times while you were doing your sports, and that's the cool thing.
Yeah, for sure. Definitely. Yeah. It was really great.
But before we bust into that, just go ahead and get this out of the way now. You had made a mention skateboarding as being a big part of your life. Was there a lot of skateboarding in Montana?
No. I mean, there was and there wasn't. In my town, there was us. There's three of us. We were the skateboarding scene. That was it.
Okay.
But the community is so worldwide, you know, it's you're connected whether you're in the same place or not. So we go to another city, we'd automatically link up with other skateboarders. You know, I would spend majority of my summers in Canada because that was the closest skate park. It was about an hour away.
Okay.
So it's like you automatically make these connections. And even when traveling outside the country, like I've skated in a lot through the Eastern Bloc of Europe, through like Bulgaria and Poland and Prague and Germany. And even with the language barrier, like you get each other, like you're connected.
Yeah.
So, even though growing up, we were the only skateboarders, which was difficult. You know, it was a lot of people were just like, oh, these kids are a bunch of troublemakers or whatever. It really made that transition to when I moved to Seattle, when I went to LA, no matter where I went, like I always had a family everywhere I went because of skateboarding, which is cool. Mm-hmm. And it was for me being in such a rural part of the country, and not having access to like much culture, music, art, anything like that, skateboarding was my window to all that. You know, old skateboard videos, you would just, at least I would create soundtracks to my favorite videos, and like I learned all this music, or, you know, a lot of the scenes in the video would have clay animation or like really cool, like Super 8 film shots and all this other cool stuff. So that really was able to like spark that creative part of me and really make me kind of appreciate that side, even though I didn't have any access to it in the tiny little town that I grew up in.
Mm-hmm.
So I always say when I talk about skateboarding that skateboarding saved my life, because if it wasn't for me, wasn't for skateboarding, I wouldn't be the person that I am today. And it gave me that eye for photography, looking through all the skateboard magazines. I mean, everything, like it literally trained my creative brain in like every aspect possible.
Oh, that's interesting. Now I heard you said you were doing skateboarding in the Eastern Bloc countries, the former Eastern Bloc countries.
Yeah, we did some trips, and that was in the book Unlawful Conduct I put out. And it was pretty much, we did kind of a skate trip through Germany, Poland, and the Czech Republic. And then I did another trip out to Bulgaria.
Mm-hmm.
And pretty much, because even growing up, you know, again, coming back to a small town, you're like, this is such a huge place and the world's so gigantic and I want to skateboard everywhere. And a lot of the videos would have these guys doing European tours or skating in other countries. So as a kid, you're always like, I wonder what skateboarding's like on the other side of the world. You know, like, what is that? So that was a huge thing I wanted to do. So when I finally was able to have money and do this trip, and that was deep into photography. So obviously you just want to go to another country to shoot photos in other places. Right. So it was kind of like
great excuse.
I know, right? It was the best of both worlds. So it was like, great, I get to go skateboard and see what it's like skateboarding on the other side of the world. But also I get to take photos while I'm doing it too. So it was a perfect marriage between the two.
How long were you traveling for?
It was, the first trip was a month, a little over a month. And then the second one to Bulgaria was a little over 2 weeks. So it was a good chunk of time to be able to kind of do it every single day, all day for a while.
What was the reason for choosing Bulgaria?
Because it was random, different.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean?
That's the best way to do it, man.
I mean, I like to go places that aren't really tourist traps. So when we were doing research about it, Bulgaria just seems so off the grid. You know, it was like a place where like a lot of people don't really go. Every time I told anybody, I was like, I'm going to go to Bulgaria. They're like, why? This is so weird. I was like, well, that's the perfect answer. That's exactly why I want to go, because I'm not going to have a whole lot of, you know, Western influence there. It's going to be pretty much just that country and its culture. So, and the vice versa was really great too, because when we're there, we met people and they're like, where are you from? I'm like, oh, we're from LA. And they look at us like we're crazy. They're like, why would you ever come here? I'm like, why the fuck would you go to Bulgaria out of all places? And you're like, this is the reason. Exactly. So,
man. So now the capital of Bulgaria is Sofia, right? Or
yep.
Is that right? So
I think it's the capital. That's where we went, with Sofia. Yeah.
Yeah. So did you go outside of Sofia and travel the countryside or maybe the other urban centers in Bulgaria?
We did. We actually went out to some of the gypsy towns.
Oh,
okay. That are outside of the city, which are crazy. You really see the presence of, you know, the Communist Party when you look and you go through these tiny little gypsy towns. And it's just like the whole city looks like a New York projects.
Wow.
But on the side of the building, you have like 1, 2, 3. So they just like numbered these gigantic project buildings. And, you know, you go to these places and you look up on the 7th floor and there's a pony or a little horse like on the 7th floor on the balcony of the place. It was crazy. We went into this little corner store to grab some stuff because our goal was to go to this old building called Buglija, which was a huge meeting place for the Communist Party. And they would have these gigantic rallies and they would do these big meetings and stuff there, and it looks like this massive concrete spaceship building on the top of the Balkans. And so I was like, all right, we got to go check this place out. It has so much history, and we couldn't get anybody to take us there because they all were just like, this is the epitome of evil to us. This is how, you know, we were kind of impressed by this group and we don't want anything to do with it. And we finally met someone who was like, all right, cool, I want to go. I haven't been there either. So we went out there. So on our way there, we went to one of their like little corner stores and grabbed some stuff. And there was all these kids that kind of rushed us, you know, probably 4, 5, 6 years old. And one of my friends bought a candy bar and gave it to the kid. And literally once the kid came outside, all the other kids like jumped him and they just start fist fighting for this candy bar. And they were like kicking each other's ass for like a little chocolate bar. It was insane. Yeah. And, of course the candy bar gets destroyed. No one gets it. And cops come, break it up. They're like pulling these kids off each other. So it was a really interesting like world out in kind of those like more gypsy towns. It was pretty crazy, you know. And
at least it didn't swarm on you like a bunch of spider monkeys or something.
I know, right? Seriously. They would have taken us too. There's numbers in them.
Wow. Was there any good skateboarding out there?
Yeah, there was. It's kind of different too because everything is so still old school. So a lot of like brick and nothing's like smooth paved roads at all.
Yeah.
But everything's made out of granite and marble. So it's really nice. Ideal. You know, like it's kind of like, oh, this is amazing. Like as long as I can get over the rough sidewalks and stuff, it's great.
Uh-huh.
And actually there was a really cool spot in Prague called Stalin Square, which actually used to be a big square and it had a big statue of Stalin. And it was kind of like this thing he built for him. And then once he fell, the locals ripped down that statue and kind of like took that back. And all the skateboarders took over that park and made their own kind of DIY skate park there.
Wow. Yeah.
So it's really interesting because you have this little area that was kind of this sign of oppression to the people there. But once he fell, they took it back. And now it's like this center of like creativity and all these kids skateboarding and kind of like, it was a really cool change from one to the other. I thought it was amazing. But again, it was like all granite and marble and it was beautiful. So that was a really fun place to go skate and experience and meet all the local kids there.
Interesting.
I'm just picturing you right against the window as you see all this granite just, it's ready for wheels.
Oh God, it was so amazing. And of course we go like the cheapest time. So it was like kind of the end of winter because we're like, oh, tickets are cheap here. So we had a battle like freezing cold while we skated, but it didn't stop us.
Oh, man.
That's dedication,
adrenaline,
man.
Adrenaline was flowing, man. It kept going.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Now, you say you went on this trip with just a couple of friends or just you and another?
A couple of my buddies also take photos. This guy named Drew Kessler, who's an amazing photographer too. and another friend, Ben Scarazzano, both just incredible photographers. So we decided to kind of just squad up on the trip and do it together and kind of see what we all could put together with all our photos.
You know, it's interesting you make that comment. You bring up your friends or photographers as well. What is it about skating culture and photography / videography that just brings these two together?
Oh man, it's half of it's just be out there having fun with your friends, right? I mean, that's kind of the beauty of it is you have, even though like I talked about, like you have your family in the skateboard community everywhere, like you kind of have your clique of friends too. You know, you have your own little group that you kind of roll with all the time. And especially when you're on the streets, like you come across some crazy shit. So it's like each of you gets each other's backs and all this stuff. But I mean, that's the beauty of it. Skateboarding is so fun. It's really about having fun and expressing yourself. So there's nothing more better than doing it with your closest friends and like all of you experiencing it together. And then all of us have the love for documenting it. So add that on top of it.
Yeah. You know,
we're having fun, but we also want to tell the stories of all the stuff we come across and the people we meet too. So it just works so harmoniously together. It's so perfect. Yeah.
You know, Casper, that was a great question because when you asked that, I immediately thought about the creativity that goes into both of those things, you know, because
right.
skateboarding is such a creative endeavor and photography. Mm-hmm. And you bring those two together. As soon as you asked that question, that just popped in my mind. I said, great question.
Well, the beauty of that too is a trick is your expression of yourself, right?
Right.
Like everybody has their own style. Everybody does everything like their own way. So you could watch five people all do the same trick and it'll all be different because it'll be their expression of themselves. So there's the challenge of documenting is how do you take a photo of someone skating or how do you take a photo of someone doing a trick where you reflect them as their person too, you know, and like their character in that trick. So you're right. Like the creativity and all that, it works so closely together. It's so nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. It seems like, I mean, it's a language unto itself. And there's a sense of dedication, not dissimilar from photography or fine arts or anything where it's not necessarily about, you can just go to school and be good. You know, it's an experience thing. It's a, you know, try and try and try again and fail the whole time until boom, that one moment of success brings with it a sense of elation that just pushes you to wanting to do it again.
Oh, yes. For sure. 100%. And the work ethic that you have to develop with it too. You know, it's like you said, you got to keep trying and you get beat up and you get hurt, but you can't give up. And I think that goes hand in hand with photography. I mean, if you're not out there doing it and you're not out there pushing yourself and putting yourself in tough situations, you're not going to get the photos that you need to get and you're not going to get the result that you need. So with that, that's another thing goes full circle about how skateboarding saved my life because the work ethic that I've developed is because of the hard work I had to put in to learn how to skateboard and everything that goes along with it too. So,
yeah.
Well, I mean, as far as the origin story, did you just go out and seek a skateboard and, you know, saw some videos, was like, this sounds cool. Or was it a friend gifted you one or you just, you know, slipped on one day and was like, what's this damn thing?
I don't know. I think I was always jumping down things. And then, I think I probably just, you know, I was really young. I started skateboarding when I was about 8 years old. So,
oh, wow.
I think I got, someone had one and I was like, fuck, this is so fun. Like, all I wanted to do was that every single day. And then I eventually got one. I think it was a Christmas present when I was about 9, like an actual real skateboard, not one of those like cheap Bart Simpson ones you get at Kmart or whatever that shit that they sell kids.
Yeah.
And it just, the obsession just kicked in. You know, it's like, it was like an instant addiction. You know, once I got on it, all I wanted to do every single day was just to do that. Just keep doing it. Yeah. So. Cool. Because there's a feeling of such satisfaction when you finally learn something and I think that goes with anything, you know what I mean? Like it could be like you're saying with football or softball or skiing or whatever it is. When you see yourself learn and progress, like all you want to do is just keep that going and you keep just saying, I can go farther with this. I can keep learning stuff. So, skateboarding for sure does it.
Hey, now, Robert, let me ask you this because, excuse me. Because I see, you know, here in the U.S., it seems like skateboarding and video photography just go hand in hand. Because a lot of times when I see these skateboarders at the skate park, there's always somebody filming or always somebody taking a photograph. Was that the same over in Bulgaria and in some of the other countries that you were working in?
A little bit, not a whole lot. I mean, that's worldwide. I think with skateboarding is like, you always want to show that you landed a trick and you did something. You know what I mean? Like, it's kind of proof that you, if you want to show it to the outside world, obviously, like, your friends see it, and that's the best part, because you're all like, we did it. But filming skateboarding is like such part of skateboarding. You know, it's creating that. That's like a huge part of it, is filming a part or putting together all your tricks. So there was a few people I saw that did it, and there were kids that were really pursuing it more on like, they want to become sponsored or they want to make a career out of it. Uh-huh. But a lot of it, people were just skating to have fun. You know, I mean, it was just kind of like they met at Stalin Square. That was like their hangout spot. Everybody got together and they skated. That's what they did with their day, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit 50-50.
It works wonderfully as that kind of connecting that common thread, to be able to break the ice or be able to conversate over something that's a similar thing. I feel it's probably an advantage for you whenever you travel, right?
Yeah. Oh, for sure. Definitely. And especially with skateboarding too, you have this ability to kind of like float by. I don't know. I always say like a lot of the photos that I have in like rougher neighborhoods or stuff like that, I feel like I get a pass because I'm on a skateboard. You know, it's because people are just like, it's just some kids skateboarding, whatever. No big deal. Like, they're used to kids being in the streets all the time skating. So even outside of the skateboard community, it kind of gives me this ability to kind of like cruise through and roll around cities or wherever I'm at without really being noticed too much.
Yeah.
And that pays off for my photography too, because it's like I can kind of be that fly on the wall a little bit and take photos and not really bring a lot of attention to myself.
Well, I can definitely tell that in a lot of your work. I mean, some of these images put you in a place that most people would, let's say, not want to be there.
That'd be good wording.
I'm just being kind on that.
I saw a comment on your work, and it talked about the grittiness and authenticity of what you're going after. That's very apparent in looking through your portfolio.
Thank you. I appreciate that. That's very nice of you to say.
Yeah,
it definitely has a ballsy nature to it. I mean, where your skateboarding has taken you into the dark recesses of various alleys. There's a mugging shot, which I'm sure you probably get asked about quite often. But the fact that you didn't get just completely stomped after that is amazing. I mean, kudos, my hat's off to you for taking the picture.
That's the one you took on that 35mm point
and shoot? Yeah, yeah, yeah. I have a little Yashica that I used to pack around with me all the time. That was my go-to camera.
Yeah.
And that was fucking crazy. I was in Vegas, and I was just cruising around in Vegas kind of off. And this wasn't like that far off the strip. This is like right where everybody's at. Uh-huh. And you know, like in Vegas, you got to take the sky bridges that usually get over the streets.
Yeah.
So I walk over this little sky bridge and I bend this corner, and just right there in front of me, this guy is, they're going at it. And like the cash is on the ground. The two dudes are fighting. And I just fucking whipped out my camera, took a photo real quick, and then just kept on pushing. I was like, well, A, they're going to chase me down, or they're so into this battle between each other that it won't even go noticed. And luckily I was able to get out and then just blend right in with the crowd and kind of disappear. But that was crazy. That was awesome. Very unexpected.
Yeah. Was that with a flash too?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the part. When I saw that, I was like, hey, okay, the picture is a very difficult situation. Again, I'm using kind words here. A fucking crazy situation is probably better.
Yeah.
But the fact that you used a flash on it and it didn't send out, you know, a big alarm, and bravo. Yeah.
Well, you know what? He's in Vegas, so they probably thought it was just another neon sign coming down.
Right? Maybe. Yeah. That totally could have been a huge benefit in my situation. Yeah. Maybe I wasn't paying attention. And at that time, I was drinking at that point in my life. So I think I had a little liquid courage in me too, where I was like, fuck it. Like, I'm just going to take this photo. Like, no big deal. So it was like a culmination of a bunch of things that helped out with that.
It's funny how alcohol makes you forget that there are thousands of graves just in the surrounding area.
Yeah, no shit, right?
It's like, dude, one of these have my name.
Out the window.
Right, right. You bring up an interesting kind of segue there. You're talking about the liquid courage and the drinking side of things. I don't mean to take us down a dark alley, but your imagery in and of itself is focused on that, and I think this subject helps play to your advantage. You have a history, or at least a familiarity with dealing with the old dreaded addiction bug.
Yeah, for sure, definitely. Yeah. Alcohol was probably definitely one of them, if anything. Yeah. And it's. I don't really know how to explain it. It could be a good thing. It could be a bad thing. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? I think with addiction, with anything, after a lot of years of it, you have to kind of pull the plug on it, right? Like, mm-hmm. you know, when you're in your 20s or in your younger years, you can kind of fuck off and do whatever you want. It's not a big deal. But there's to a certain point where it's going to start putting a toll on your life.
Right.
And for me, it was kind of, it ended up being a lot of fun situations to a lot of bad situations. And
yeah.
That's how it progressed to a point where I was like, all right, you know, there's only one way this is going to end. I need to stop drinking and stop being stuck in these horrible situations I'm in, or I'm going to continue this and I'll probably die young, mm-hmm. if not from a bad situation, from the harm that I'm doing to my body. So yeah, at some point I just had to pull the plug on it, and mm-hmm. it kind of dawned on me that it's now or never kind of a thing.
Yeah.
Yeah,
they gotta say, what is it? You know, before 21, it's a party. After 21, it's a problem.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah,
but I mean, I bring that up as just kind of foundation for much of your work seems to revolve around issues of addiction. I know before the show, we were talking about a project that you're looking into documenting the people dealing with particularly meth. Is that right?
Yep.
Yeah. Do you want to kind of explain that a little bit? I know it's something that you've been working on for a while here.
Yeah, it's, you know, I have a connection with people who have drug abuse or alcohol abuse or some sort of addiction, right? Like I'm not an outside person where I'm like, all right, let me objectify you and just point out all the bad qualities of you. Like I understand what their mindset's at. I understand those lows and those highs, and I understand that feeling of needing something and having that be a control over your life, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that's obviously something that is close to me. Like it has some sort of personal connection with. So when I see people who are struggling with addiction or drug use or whatnot, like there's a natural connection for me to want to kind of talk to them, and whether I can help them out or not, or tell a story, and maybe a photo I can take with them can help affect someone else down the road that's dealing with this addiction, right? Mm-hmm. So. And then with meth, in Montana, it was a big problem. There's a lot of meth in Montana. They've had these crazy huge billboard campaigns they did trying to scare people away from meth. Like it's always been kind of a thing with Montana, and especially a lot of rural towns in general. But I noticed there isn't any stories about coming out of it. You know, people who are recovering from meth and who are able to defeat that monster and change their life and make it to a better place. You know, majority of everything about meth is you're a monster. Once you touch it, you're damned for the rest of your life. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to do this project where I was telling the success stories of people who have battled with meth and, you know, kind of talking down their crazy road that they took on, because that's a beast in itself, you know. And the stories that I've been hearing from people, it's just crazy. There's one guy who was a user. He ended up being a cooker and a dealer, got a shootout with the police, went to prison, and now he's a pastor of a church.
Mm.
So here you hear all these really crazy stories from people and like the deep, dark roads that this drug takes them down. So I wanted to really kind of start a project where people can understand that you can get out of it. Like there is hope. There is light at the end of the tunnel. And hopefully with these stories and these photos that people who are struggling with it can be like, all right, like maybe there I can help myself out. Maybe I can do something about this and try to bring a little bit of encouragement into their life to help motivate them to stop using and kind of get away from it.
That's, you know, fantastic.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's great when you can use your photography to make a difference. You know, that's the ultimate, really.
That's the point, right?
Yeah.
Like exactly.
What I think about, you know, photography, and I have a lot of friends who are in fashion and stuff. And that's cool. You know, you do your thing. But for me, we're only on this planet for a short amount of time. So and what can really resonate and can make a difference generations and generations down the road is the power of imagery and a, mm-hmm. and a powerful photo. So at least to me, that's my main goal is I know when I'm gone and I'm past, like hopefully some of these photos can help people out down the road or help with a cultural change or kind of show the history of where we were at so we don't make the same mistakes going down the road. You know, I think mm-hmm. that's the biggest thing for me, like a need to have an impact, whether it's good or bad, on the world through your photos, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely important. And I'm glad that the subject that you're approaching is something like, well, meth, for instance, it's not one of those, you're right, that you see all of these success stories and so forth. I mean, over the last, couple of decades, you see a lot of the alcohol, overcoming alcoholism or heroin or, you know, things like this. They've been big in media and television and so forth. But the only thing that you ever hear about meth is usually, you know, those shitty memes you see on Facebook on before and after.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. You see the before and after trying to scare you off of meth, but...
But they don't talk about the people who got out of it. You right. know, it's all bad, like what... it's all Breaking Bad.
Yeah, and it's sad. It's really, really sad because there's a lot of people who have been able to do it. And there's a lot of people that battle with meth. Meth is a really big problem in this country. Yeah. And
and it's one that we precipitate with the way that our culture and our pharmaceuticals and everything are established here in their system.
Yeah, exactly. And what was really interesting to me is when I talked to a lot of people who are recovering, they said that when they're in NA meetings and stuff like that, they're always treated as the outcasts. Like people, you know, you have your heroin addicts or, you know, cocaine or whatever your poison is. But they were always, it was almost every time when I talked to somebody who was recovering, they said they were always feeling like the outcast. And there's not like, not to I'm aware of, there's not like a hotline you can call just for meth, or there are a few places that do, I think, meth meetings or rehabilitation, but as a whole, it's kind of looked down part, even in the recovery process. So, or at least that's what the experience I heard from other people. So yeah, it's sad. I think there needs to be someone to shine a little bit more positive light on the truth that you can recover from it.
You know? Well, support is greatly important when it comes to somebody's recovery. If just having somebody, a friend or a family member that's willing to, you know, lend you an ear or have an open cell phone whenever you need to call, like that makes all the difference in the world. Because, I mean, it's something that's affected my life, or not my life directly, but growing up where I did, you alluded earlier, rural areas tend to be more likely to have that type of an epidemic, which is what I've noticed myself where I'm from, that I have friends that I went to school with that we lost either by way of or indirectly through.
Yep. Oh, yeah, it's everywhere. And now, you know, I was shadowing some of the Northern Border Patrol agents on this project, kind of talking to them about it. And now it's a big thing where it used to be this kind of like home cookers, you know, the guys that have the little meth labs and these little houses and stuff. But now mm-hmm. it's the cartel. That cartel is like making huge pushes on it. And a lot of the meth is being brought up by these super labs that's been made from the cartel. And then they are bringing it all up to the border. So now it's a little bit cheaper and it's a lot more pure. So now we have it. It's even more dangerous because now we're dealing with a criminal organization, a stronger product that's cheaper for people to buy.
With the economies of scale that they can do it on, they can sell cheaper and good stuff. Yeah,
for sure. So it's not going to go away anytime soon. So
as far as the project, how far along are you? Are you looking at, have you got something produced out there for people to see yet? Or is it something that's upcoming?
It's definitely upcoming. I started it last summer. Mm-hmm. And so I've been doing a lot of interviews with people. It's kind of hard to connect with people one-on-one in that kind of world.
I can imagine.
Yeah. So, but it's definitely going to be a project that's going to take a few years. You know, like I met with a lady who used to be a nurse. She got bad into it, almost killed herself, cut her stomach open. She was saying that she wasn't able to have children. And now I think any time now she's going to be having her first baby. So I think the story is progressing really nicely, and I think it's definitely to do it the way I want it to do it and the way that I would like it to turn out. It's going to be a couple of years running a little project because I want to follow these people's lives down the road.
Yeah,
you know, there's another guy who was living in his van, has children was taken away from him. That's another huge part of this is all the children in, that go to in the protective services or go underneath the government or up for adoption. Such a huge number, at least in Montana, are from families taken away from meth. So that's like another big aspect is all these children who are pretty much orphans because of dealing with the meth epidemic that their parents have dived into. So there was another guy, he's living in his van, his children have been taken away from him. All he wants to do is get his life back on the track, get his children back. That's like his number one source. So I talked to him the other day. He now is in housing. He's in like a group housing. He's not living in his van anymore. He's got work. He's looking at getting his children back. So I think the project is going to have its most impact of seeing how these people's lives develop down the road and showing the positive changes that they're making and all the positive rewards that are coming from those changes that they made in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
How are you connecting with these people? I mean, I'm assuming you're not just like walking down the street and injecting.
Yeah.
Are you just kind of...
It's a little bit of different things. Yeah. People that I know that know people, or, you know, I work with the Border Patrol. So I see that aspect of it from the law enforcement side. Right. And then, you know, surprisingly enough, Craigslist has been a great tool for that. Because if you look at the mentality of especially a user, they're like up all night doing weird things at weird hours, you know. So like I catch a lot of people just like responding to these like random posts on Craigslist, and then I end up calling them and talking with them, and then they share it with people that they know, and it's kind of just snowball effect of just a bunch of different kind of ways to get a hold of people. But I was blown away that like I just one day I was like, I'll put up a Craigslist ad just out of shits and giggles and see what happens. And I had like 50 responses within like a matter of a week of people like, hey, I know somebody that's dealing with it, or I have somebody in my family that's dealing with it, or my husband is in prison because of this. Like, you should tell the story. So it also shows how people who are dealing with this or have been involved with it are looking for places and outlets to talk about it and to actually try to do something good for it, which speak volumes to me, because there isn't a lot of, there isn't a lot of places to help for it. So anything that's out there, like, people will find it and try to follow up on it, because all they want is some sort of positive outlet or something to tell these stories to help affect people. So, and there's a really cool project in Montana called the Montana Meth Project. And they do a lot of, working in the community. They do all these billboards. They're very proactive in it too. So I've been talking with them a little bit, trying to work together. So they've been doing this for years. So they're a really good source of information and places to point me in the right direction too.
Oh, that's awesome. And yeah, we'll get the link and information for that. So if anybody that's out there listening, is interested in sharing that information with somebody they may know, we'll have that in the show notes.
Yeah, definitely. They're good people.
Yeah. Good deal. Now I want to flip it a little bit here, because I on your website you have that Hurricane Irma.
Yep.
That, you know, and that, you know, how did you were down there in the water? I mean, literally boots on the ground.
Yeah.
Getting those images. Can you tell us about that project a little bit?
That was wild. I had plans to go to New York, literally like a week before the hurricane was going to hit. And so I decided, you know, I'm going to go down there. I actually was trying to fly in the day that it hit, but obviously all the flights canceled. So I had to, had to be delayed a couple of days.
Yeah. Leave it to a photographer to go. I don't give a shit about the 200 mile an hour winds. I need my plane to drop me right in the heart.
Exactly. Yeah. Put me right in the eye, please. I'll give you a parachute. I'll jump into it.
Hear gunshots, run toward them.
Yeah. Oh, seriously. So, and then I decided, well, I want to show the aftermath. I think you see in the news a lot is people of it happening, right? And it's kind of like, this is it. The hurricane's about to hit, yada, yada, yada. And then once it hits, it's on to the next thing. And you really saw that with Hurricane Irma, is because you got a hurricane to Puerto Rico was literally like days after Hurricane Irma hit. So I wanted to show the aftermath of it and what people were dealing with a week after, you know, the hurricane, and like what the fallout right. really was. Like, how were these neighborhoods dealing with this? Like, was FEMA helping out a lot? How was, you know, you're looking a week later without power, food, all the stuff that came along with it. So I really wanted to show that. And so, yeah, I kind of went down there. I picked a few places to just to kind of dive into and talk to people and meet with them and walking through flooded neighborhoods. It was quite an experience for sure. It was very, very impactful.
Yeah, and it, you know, and I can understand that when you say how the news cycle just moves on to the next big story, and you don't really see the aftermath. And I mean, Casper has done the same thing with her Hurricane Katrina. I mean, you get down and you pretty much finish up where the news people left off, you know. Yeah. And sometimes that's the more important story.
I think
everybody
so.
yeah, you know, I mean, everybody sees the, you know, the hurricane. I mean, that's all juicy, nice, you know, nice news, but how are these people dealing with it afterwards? And yeah, I mean, that's a great point of reference, you know, a great way to approach it.
And I would interject here, I mean, it was a similar case of course when it comes to the hurricane stuff, but there was a significant differentiation though, because with Katrina had the benefit, if you could use that word, allow me to use that word in the sentence, of not having a major storm directly behind it. And so it was able, the media was able to kind of latch onto it and keep it in the nation's awareness for far longer. When it comes to Irma and really any of those hurricanes, the three or four that really blasted us, it was like one after the next, and you don't have enough time to spend on one. So the people of the victims of Irma get forgotten almost immediately.
Yeah. And to the argument, Puerto Rico was devastating. I think on a scale
still
of
to this day even, is bad.
Yeah. You know what I mean? And on a scale of even Texas and Florida, like Puerto Rico got it by far the worst than anybody else did. There's no hands down about it. But even before, but there's still people that need, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's, and you do need to tell their story. And of course, because I'm from the States, like to me, I wanted to tell that story from the States, because I think other countries have this idea that we have this huge source of resources, right? And like we just come in and clean things up and everything's all good, which obviously wasn't the case. You know, compare it between with the fires this summer or this year and the hurricane, like it was such a huge bill for this country to kind of the front. It was millions and millions and millions of dollars. So I want to show, you know, we only have so many resources and it's definitely like running thin. So I noticed that a lot shooting the people in Florida, because, you know, the nicer neighborhoods obviously got all their power and everything first. And then there was a neighborhood, an elderly community that I was focusing on, that they were kind of just left in the dust for a while. I mean, it was literally it was like a trailer park, and easy 50% of the whole community was completely destroyed. If you look at the homes, they have, and you probably noticed this, Casper, that they had like a red paper on the door, a yellow and a green, you know, one's inhabitable, one needs work on, red means it's uninhabitable, that they're going to have to tear down the building.
Yep. So, I remember that.
And a majority of this elderly community, this trailer park community, was all red. Like, it was really bad. And these are people who are, you know, in their 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, kind of on their own. Like, they need, if anything, they need power for any kind of medical reasons. You know, they're not as resourceful because they're in their older ages. So that was one neighborhood I really want to show a lot of. And it was frustrating because after I got done with this project, I sent it to a bunch of news sources, and everybody just said, well, we've already covered enough Irma. Like, we're done with it. Like, we posted enough stories about it. Like, we don't need to post any more about it. Like,
and there it is.
Yeah. And I'm like, you know, it's you're the internet. Like, you don't have like a certain amount of pages that you can print on. You know, I understand
you're
if
not
it's a
limited.
Newspaper. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, what's it going to hurt you to show these people that what they're going through. And maybe somebody in that community will come help out because of those photos, or somebody will come that lives in another county will come down and do something about it. But they're like, no, we've already covered enough of it. Like, we're on to Puerto Rico. Like, that's the main source. That's all we really care about. So that was pretty discouraging to hear that from several sources, major ones too. So,
yeah,
but I guess it's the nature of the beast.
Yeah, they act like they're limited by their fucking paper.
Still. I know, right? Like, you can't, I mean, unlimited, like you said, what the fuck?
Yeah, you have, like you said a while ago, you got a damn website and you can post as many as you want. The internet's not going to say no.
Right? Exactly. So that was kind of discouraging.
But that's one of our, I find is one of our biggest issues in this country is the inability to multitask. And be able to focus on more than one issue at a given time. It's everybody has this narrow tunnel vision that, oh, I can't be worrying about Irma because Maria is happening. I can't be worrying about Maria because, you know, the next one is right around the corner. And I just don't have the capacity to keep that in my brain. At least that's what the media conveys and attempts to push into people's mind.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they want traffic too, right? So whatever is like the hot new thing, that's what they're going to focus on because you have to play off the fear of people. So if a storm's already gone, there's nothing to be afraid about. Now it's like responsibility. Like, what do you do to help out your community? Like, what do you do to help people out? So once the fear aspect's gone, it's on to what can we show now to scare people? Like, what we gotta hold their attention, you know? And it's difficult, like, to be the devil's advocate on their part. It is such a crazy information hub now, and things go in so in and out so fast, and it's really hard to keep people's attention. So I understand somewhat of that idea, but you don't have to run it on the front page of the website. Just like have an article there so people can stumble across it. You know what I mean? Like, it's not, it doesn't need to be headline news, but it should still be news at some point or some way, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Throw it below the fold, page four, whatever it is. At least keep a light on it. Don't just cut it all the way off.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, your experiences down there, and you were talking about wading through the waters, and if it's anything like I remember how Katrina was, it's like the water is, well, at that point, it's no longer water. It's just liquid chaos.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it's pretty bad.
Yeah. And how long were you out there? I mean, just, you know, moving about in this stuff.
About 2 days I spent out there. So I was driving down to, I was actually going to go down to the Keys. Because the Keys was where it was hit really, really, really bad. But they had National Guards there, and it was just one of those things where you had to have a pass to get through the security to the National Guard, and I didn't know too many people down there. So, and I was like, well, there's a lot of tension on the Keys right now. Like, there's people reporting on it. Like, it's being covered. That's fine. So, I drove down, and I came across this this town, and I could see the whole neighborhood was flooded. Like, you could just see just completely, like, I was like, all right, well, I'm going to pull in there and see what this is all about. And then I started to kind of go through, and it was the areas, there was a whole trailer park area that was all migrant workers. A lot of them were there for like 5 days, and still not a single person came by to see if they needed water or anything. They were like completely on their own. I mean, the neighborhood, you can see from the photos, it's just completely submerged. So I spent 2 days there with them, and the water was pretty rough. Kind of everything has that oil sheen on it because all the cars and everything is flooded. So there's just oil everywhere. We're talking about trailer parks and kind of more low income housing houses. So you have septic backup into the water. Garbage cans are floating everywhere. Yeah. And really, the only people I really saw out there helping were animal activists going around and trying to find pets that were stranded. There was like a lot of cats. The cats and the chickens were getting along just fine because they both knew they were in a shitty situation.
Oh, they're survivors, man.
So they're like, we're going to stick together. So yeah, that was rough. It was sad. It was really scary because a lot of locals said they saw alligators and snakes in the waters.
Oh, man.
I was about to ask about the old creatures.
Wow. Yeah, so I was pretty freaked out because the water's so dark and muggy that you can't see anything. So you wouldn't be able to see anything coming your way. No way. And I kind of like, I walk around, I'm in these neighborhoods, and I look around, and I'm the only person in the water. Like the only, like it's, oh, it looks like
you're the only fresh meat out there.
Yeah, seriously. I'm like, I'm a sitting duck right now. And, you know, like, oh, maybe this is a bad idea. But fuck it. I'm here now. So I've already gone in. So might as well do it.
I admire you before, because if I was alligator bait, I'd be out of there in a minute.
Yeah. Hey,
to be fair, animals got to eat too.
Yeah. I was thinking to myself, I was like, man, the things I do to get a good photo. Like, it was kind of one of those moments where, like, this is kind of ridiculous. But, you know,
man, whatever. You're my hero, man.
But the thing is, you're not out there just for the pictures. You're actually developing stories and talking with these people.
Yeah.
And, like, how was the attitudes? How was the fortitude with the individuals that you were talking to?
You know, it was unbelievably positive, like, considering the situation that we're in. Everybody was obviously bummed and traumatized from it.
Right.
But they all had a positive light on it. They're like, well, you know, like, we can only go out from here. Like, we're going to work as a community and make things happen. So I think that was really an empowering thing to watch, was the resilience of us as humans, but of the resilience of, like, being together as a community and helping each other out, because they didn't have any resources there. I didn't really see much of FEMA. I didn't see much of anything else. Like, people, there was, like, it really was just groups of people from outside counties setting up areas for water and food and, like, help and stuff like that. So that was really cool to see. But there were some really sad stories too. A guy that I met, he lost his dog, found his dog. Someone killed his pet during this whole, like, thing. Yeah. And it was because I asked him, like, he had a tattoo of his dog on his leg. I'm like, oh, is this your pet? He's like, yeah. Like, someone actually grabbed him during all this and, like, killed him. And it was like, literally, like, cut the dog's head off. So there was some really horrible stuff that you hear from what people were dealing with too. So I don't know. It was sad. And then in the elderly community, it was tough. You know, there, a lot of people took advantage of them. So there's a lot of people looting. And then there was a lot of people coming in pretending to be cleanup crews. And what they were really doing was stealing all the aluminum and metal from people to go recycle it and get the money. So you had to deal with a lot of these aspects of people taking advantage of people that are in need or abusing the situation in itself too. So it was kind of a mix.
It always seems like we end up seeing the extremes. When the worst of times happen, you see the best of people and the worst of people, but there's, you know, the very little gray area.
Yeah, there's really not a lot of in between.
Yeah.
Unfortunately. But I guess I don't know really where the in between would sit in a situation like that, right?
I don't think it really has an option to be a middle ground.
Yeah, you can't
have to kind of take a
sit on your porch.
It's black and white. You're either hero or villain.
Yeah exactly. I saw a lot more heroes than I did villains, so that's just a great good thing.
That's positive
for sure.
Yeah.
Hey, before we run out of time, I think we need to talk about your book.
Yes.
Okay. Cool.
Yes.
Yes, yeah, let's leap over to that. Conduct,
and that 35mm camera.
Yeah,
I want to hear all about it. Talk about that book.
That book was about 5 years of photos. And it kind of was a point in my life of being somewhat, like, rebellious. You know what I mean? I was hanging out with a lot of graffiti guys, and we were out skating, and it was, like, deep into my alcohol abuse. So it was like we always catch ourselves in, like, silly situations, and then it was also the stuff that came along with it, kind of the more gritty, nitty things we would come across and things you would kind of almost categorize as unlawful conduct. So I put that body of work together using just a little point and shoot 35mm camera. That was just like my go-to, my little Yashica I'd had in my pocket all the time. And then it was kind of just like the stuff that we came across while we were out in the streets and just kind of the experience over those 5 years. So. And
and the book is called Unlawful Conduct as well, right?
Yep.
Now, the most fascinating part about it is how unapologetic the pictures are, the depictions. I mean, the rawness and the absolute just showcase is phenomenal. I like it because I enjoy those types of gritty approaches. It's reality.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the real deal.
You're not
deal,
sugarcoating
right?
shit, you know? Yeah.
No need.
No need.
it's just like they said, gritty and authentic, you know, gritty and authentic.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
But there's a sense of poetry to it though.
Thank you.
That's what's impressive to me is like you take these really unfortunate aspects, but you apply a sense of poetry that just kind of follows you from one picture to the next. And it's a good sequence. I really enjoy it.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. Yeah, it was a really fun project. It was my first book I've ever put out, and the process of making a book is fantastic. I loved every single bit of it.
Is there quotes here?
No, 100% authentic, okay. Like happiness. I took on everything in itself. The only difficult part, I'll never do this again, is I made a custom case for it, and that was a fucking nightmare to try to.
Freelander approach.
Yeah. but I did everything. I sourced the printer. I worked with the printer closely on paper, ink. I designed this whole case. I produced, manufactured the case myself. I did all the shipping, the wholesaling, the press, everything for it. Like, I completely took it all on 100% my own, and it was really fun. I enjoyed a lot of it, and it was very gratifying to see it actually like do well and be in some places that I would never imagine it be sold at. So.
Nice. Now, when was it released?
It was released early 2015, I believe. Okay. Yeah. So,
and it was a limited release, too. There's only, 100 copies?
Yep, just in 100. They all had this. I did this huge, I put all the materials for the cover and painted this big graffiti piece on it, and then cut out the cases out of that piece. So every case has its own unique, like, actual painted. And then I hand signed, numbered all the books. And then the case comes with a little photo print inside of it too. So you got like a signed print, and then you got the book assigned, numbered, and then you got this special like custom case with every of them. So.
All right, so your first book did all, you weren't fucking around. You just came out swinging.
Yeah, you got it, right? You have to.
And I came out with a lousy paperback.
Me too. I was like, blurb, sure, ISBN, yeah. I can get that. This man's over here like, I'm going to etch into the cover. I'm going to make all kinds of shit here.
You got to do it right.
Man, I feel worthless now.
Hey,
my shit didn't sell.
The case was a headache, man. Like, in theory, the idea was I made it, I produced one copy of it, and then I went to Tokyo, and I was like, all right, here's the deal. If I can get a bookstore in Japan to co-sign on this, I'll get the rest of the world to do it, because these guys are immaculate in like every detail possible. So there's this really amazing photography store in Tokyo called So Books, and he's got like original signed books. I mean, it's unbelievable. So I brought it into him. I was like, what do you think of this? And the first thing he did, he grabbed it and was smelling the papers and smelling the ink. And he was like inspecting the binding and looking at it.
A definite printer.
Yeah. And looking at it. And then after passing the quality control aspect of it, then he looked actually at the pictures. And then he's like, all right, cool. I'll buy a couple copies. And then that was the point where I was like, all right, this has some potential. Like, I can actually do something with this book. So I had to get that cosign from Japan for sure.
Yes. When somebody smells the book and says yes, then you're game on. Yeah. Go ahead, Joe.
I'm laughing because I could see if I had come in there with my book, I would have been thrown out, and then the book would have been right after me. I just had this mental image. I'm rolling down the street with my book.
Not with Japanese. They'd be very polite until you ask you to leave very nicely.
Just hand it back. But now the book sold out, and you sold this in 8 countries. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's great.
It actually pre-sold out before I even got done printing with it.
Wow.
So I was able to have.
Right. I saw that. Yeah.
Yeah. So I was able to have everybody pre-order it before it got done. So it was all the copies were claimed before I even got it back from the printer.
Damn, which is unfortunate. I would have loved a copy. Yeah. Right. That's what I was thinking. And actually, to that point, it's limited. So trying to find it's going to be problematic. But I did see before, actually, as of recording this show, which this is probably going to change by the time it publishes, there is one copy on Amazon that's available.
Oh, yeah. No, the Amazon. Oh, really? Because I had the original copy on there and I took it off because
did you?
It had some photos on there that I wasn't supposed to be in there. So I had to do, make a final edit.
I'm going to go to Amazon.
So buy that shit right now.
Unless someone's reselling it, which is a possibility that maybe someone has a copy up there. But you can also, I think Need Supply has one or two copies left, last time I checked. And then Skylight Books, I just popped into Skylight Books in LA, and they had a couple copies too. So there's a couple floating around out there, I believe.
Okay.
So I checked, there was a couple other ones I know they were sold out of, but I'm almost positive those two stores still have a couple for sure.
That's great, because we have an audience that has an affinity for photo books. So hopefully somebody listening out there will track that down and it'll find a new home.
Cool. They should
like. Yeah, definitely. Let us know too.
Yeah.
Now, before we move away from it, at what point did you realize that this was going to be a project, to be a book? Where did you kind of go into this 6 years knowing, hey, this, I'm going to make something out of this? Or was there just a holy shit moment?
It was kind of a combination of two. It was really like I had this body of work. And at that time, it's after getting injured and not skating or snowboarding and skating as much anymore, I started focusing on photography as a profession. That's kind of was that whole book was me coming into myself as a documentary photographer, like me learning the camera, learning my style, which will always continue till the day I die, obviously. But it was kind of me finding myself. So at the end, I had all these photos and I was like, I want to do something with this, because I was kind of in a change of where I'm going to go hop over to the dark side of digital. I'm not going to shoot as much film anymore. I really want to have like a body of work at that stage in my life. Like I'm sober now. So like a lot of that stuff that I would have been taking photos of back then, I don't take photos of anymore. So it was kind of like a combination of, all right, I have all this work. This is a huge part of my photography life that this chapter's changing now. And I just kind of wanted to highlight like that part of my life there in that book. And it kind of feels good because I can move on to the next thing.
Exactly.
I feel like I put that body of work out. Now I'm focusing more on better storytelling, more journalism, like kind of really trying to like up my level of a photographer. So I think I try to do that. I've been wanting to do this with books. Is the next one out, I want to do one that's more like, this is how much I've grown. And obviously, and then the next one, I'll push myself to do something a little bit more better, more in deep, like maybe a really long-term project that takes years, but a lot more work to do another book. So I'm trying to use these books as like levels of my progression as a photographer.
So 6 years wasn't long enough?
maybe not.
Got to go for enough. A decade.
You know what
no,
I mean?
No, it isn't. Yeah, and you'll right. always find yourself going, damn, this picture I got yesterday would have been great in this book.
All the time. I remember when I finally got the final copy of the book, I took a couple good photos the next day. I was like, fuck, I want this in there. I want this in there. Like that addiction never stops.
No, I still look at my first one and I'm like, oh God, why did I publish that? I just want to reach out to the Library of Congress and
both,
go.
Man.
I just want to reach out to the Library of Congress and go, can I remove that and give you a different one as my first? Because people are going to look back on this shit. Yeah. People are going to see this. Maybe if I die, go off to the stars and become one, who knows? That's very, very not likely. But but that's what they look back on and they go, oh my God, look at this horrible book that he started with.
Oh, I know. I'm sure everybody's going to be saying that about the one I put out too.
I don't think so on that one. Now, I do want to kind of jump into a different subject really, really quick and touch on is your willingness to use mixed media or even manipulation to a point on some imagery.
Yeah, totally.
That's one of the things. It's always kind of one of those debates of how much of the photographer is going to change it or apply themselves into a scene. Can you speak on that a little bit?
Yeah, I love mixed media. I think it's great. I think it adds, it can complement a photo so well, especially with some of the graffiti photos that you can see on the website. I have these photos layered on top of actually like tags and actual graffiti itself. So, and I think that brings some, a little bit more of connection to the photo. You know what I mean? It brings another element to the image. So, and I love texture. I'm a huge one of texture. So I do a lot of these photos like layered on top of like marble or broken glass and stuff like that. Like, I think it's really cool. I don't really Photoshop my photos too much. I tried not to. The only thing I really work in is Lightroom. So I'll do like some, color grading and stuff like that. But I think using the mixed media is kind of like my way of like feeling I could be like more of an artist and more creative without doing a lot of image altering. So I do that a lot, but I'm a huge fan of it. I'm supported. I think it's part of the artistic vision. It's the emotion you want to portray in the image. And sometimes that little extra flavor can make a huge difference on the end result of the photo. So.
No, I'm glad you talked about that. Cause it's always kind of one of those debates when the topic of documentary photography or journalism comes up and the argument of, holding to a scene and not putting too much of yourself into it. But I mean, I'm sure with your skater culture and your background and your relationship with graffiti and so forth, and the textures, actually, it's a big part of your art. And you're right, it allows you to be able to express yourself a little bit more and be an artist more than anything.
For sure. And the thing with the book too, to talk back about that, the reason I painted these cases and like used a lot of chrome paint and stuff is because a lot of the photos in that book was graffiti oriented. So I wanted when you open the book, it smelled like paint. Like I wanted the chrome to rub off on your fingers. Like if you were actually like out there painting. So like this just brings another sense into the images, you know? So you're not only doing it through your visual, you're doing it through your smell, and you have texture on your fingers too. So I think that was like a huge part of it. And with my photojournalism, I don't really do a lot of that. Like Unlawful Conduct was a photo book, but it also was kind of an art project too. That's why a lot of the photos are a little bit abstract, and there's some actual art in there and some other random shit. But like I do support with the photojournalism part is the photo is the photo. Like that's the main point of it. You know what I mean? And I think with my mixed medium with photojournalism, I like to do audio. I think that's like the big connection, because you're not really manipulating the photo. You're not changing the scenery. You're not like making something look like it's not, but adding the media of audio with it, like that really pulls through the story with the photos. I mean, you can see a photo and you can really connect with the image, but when you hear that person's voice, there's something in your brain when you just like hear their voice and what they sound like, it becomes so much more real. So I think that's where I mix media with my more photojournalism is the audio part of it.
Now trying to let's do a quick pivot here to your American trip that's coming up. Before we were recording, you were talking about a Kickstarter. You're working on a video beforehand. Tell us about that. You're looking at what, 40 states? Is that what you're trying to do?
Yeah. So I'm fascinated with America. I always have been. Even when I go to other countries, like I love taking photos of other countries, but there's something about America that's just like, it clicks in my brain, like 100%. And it's probably because one of my biggest influences is Robert Frank, the American photo book. So even when I first started, I was like, I've always wanted to do this. I want to do a book on America because I think America is going through a huge cultural shift. You know, we are the generation that knows pre-internet, pre-cell phone. Like we understand the kind of that older school lifestyle. And now we have a whole new generation that has no idea. You know what I mean? Like never used a payphone in their life. Like it's always cell phones, internet. Like that's what it's about. And that's what it's going to be now forever. So I think with that, the political landscape, you know, this conversation on guns, the opioid crisis, and just like America as a whole, I think this is like a huge shift, kind of like how Robert Frank did post-World War II. You know, like America was making a huge change after that. So it's really...
It's like, look at us, warts and all.
Exactly. So I really think that now is the time to do another book, or do a book on America as a whole, and just like really portray it in its like unfiltered state and like kind of where we're going at. That's the project. I've been building a collection of photos over the last few years of like all the places in America that I've been, but I have a decent amount of work, but I think I like to do a nice long trip, like take time, 40 plus states, even all states, if I can raise enough money for it and really put together, like that'll probably be my next book, is just like my visual love letter to America and like American culture and all that. So we should be getting, I should be having the Kickstarter up like in a couple of days. So probably by the time this is released, it'll be up and going. And then, if I can raise enough money to swing it, man, it's going to be, and we're going everywhere, small rural towns. I mean, every bit of America that I can get my hands into, it's what I'm going to try to do. So,
wow.
Are you going to approach that? What is that? That road trip that they say to be able to hit every state?
I'll send you guys a photo. I have a photo of like it kind of mapped out, like, what our little travel is going to be. And it's a lot of zigzagging, like just like all over the place. You know what I mean?
Up, down, backtrack.
Oh man, that sounds so much fun.
Yeah, it's good. And I'm going to be doing it with
that would be
my
amazing
colleague. I brought his name up earlier, Ben Scott Arzano. He's another amazing photographer. And so we're going to kind of work on that together because he's got a really cool eye. He, again, his background in skateboarding, He's a good partner in crime and all that. So we're going to kind of try to do that together and hopefully put out something that represents America properly.
That's awesome. That's
awesome. Looking forward to it, man.
Thank you. I hope it makes, hope it happens.
One thing I want to get out, one more thing rather I want to get out there is I know it's want, W-A-N-T, but with parentheticals. Yeah. What can you explain that for me real quick? Because I've been staring that out on your name here. I'm like, what does this mean?
Want was like a skate crew that we started like 5 or 6 years ago. So that's kind of like the branding name. It stands for Whores and Thieves. And it was kind of like, it's our crew, you know what I mean? And that's kind of like our brand underneath stuff. So like whenever we do stuff together, we put together a project or whatever, we kind of just all put it underneath like that brand name and kind of try to work together. Cause like I'm a huge fan of bringing your friends with everything. Like I think your friends are your family. Community, you know what I mean? Yes. So if anything you ever see me do, like always shout out to all the homies. Like I'm always trying to put them on. I think everybody that I work with has such an amazing talent and they're so good at what they do that when we work together as a crew, like stuff turns out amazing. So, yeah, that's kind of it. That's the posse.
In photography, they call that collectives. It sounds just like an unofficial one.
Hey, Robert, you want to send a shout out to any of them?
Oh, of course, for sure. Obviously Drew Kessler, that, man. Ben Scarazzano. Everybody check out Udo Carita. He is an unbelievable fashion photographer in LA and just an artist altogether. So he's good. The homie Sam Roberts is a great videographer. Chris Williams makes music, photos, video. Like all these guys are on point. They're amazing. So you will not be you will be satisfied whatever you see with them for sure.
Excellent.
Sweet. Whole army
of course. You got it, man. It's the family.
Right on. Well, Jim, you want to go ahead and toss out that that last question?
Well, yeah. Let me ask you this, Robert. If you could just think of back in time and let's say from the inception of the camera.
Okay.
And if there's any place you could shoot it at any time, where would you go?
Oh man, I would say this might sound lame, but America right now. I don't think I go back in time at all.
Okay,
I think this is such a unique point in our history. I think there's so much shifting and so much crazy stuff going on that I'd want to just be here now, seeing what's going to happen and what's going to happen for the future. But I would change the industry to like maybe back in the 50s and the 60s when photographers were getting paid a lot more and sent on assignments.
I'm so glad you made that statement.
That's the one thing I think.
We want the same problems to document, but we want to actually get paid the way that it once was.
That's my ideal world right
of
there.
Of course, adjusted for the current cost.
Yeah, of course.
Because we had a recent interview, Summerstein. Actually, I'd heard you mention you had a great admiration for the Martin Luther King picture with him from behind during Selma. Our previous interview was with the photographer that took that.
So awesome. I noticed that I was looking at some stuff earlier this morning and I saw his interview and I was like, oh, when I get done with this, I'm gonna listen to this because that was a very influential photo I saw, you know, and I want to have photos that stick with history and show those huge changes in history and culture and everything. So that photo is unbelievably amazing. Like it's stuck with me through all these years and kudos to him because he took an amazing photo. That's for sure.
Yeah. And the interesting thing he brought up during that time was at one point, any photographer out there that keeps track of, you know, the past legends know of Eugene Smith. Yeah. And he talked about having the opportunity. He met Eugene Smith at a gallery and had the opportunity to buy one of his prints originals for $30.
Oh my God, that's amazing!
Yeah. Which today is probably like $30,000.
Yeah, that's a good investment right there. That's for sure.
But being a scrappy poor college kid, you know, at the time you didn't think anything of it because you just couldn't buy it. But now you look back and it's like, damn, like Bitcoin.
Yeah, seriously. Yeah. Right. Well, that's cool because his Eugene Smith is my Eugene Richards. Like if I can meet that guy and sit down and talk with him, I would be ecstatic because besides Robert Frank, he's probably the other most influential photographer to me, at least Like, his stuff is unbelievable. So good.
Yeah.
Nice name drop. Yes.
Yeah, Holler. If you're hearing Eugene, give me a call.
There we go. So let's do this. Where can people find out more about you and see more of your work online?
Go to my website for sure, photosbyrobertleblanc.com. That's pretty much got everything on there that I want you to see. And you can do Instagram, Photos by Robert LeBlanc on Instagram. It's pretty much my two main sources. But I try to get everybody to go to the website because I think that portrays the images the way that I want them to be shown. So photosbyrobertleblanc.com.
Nice.
Cool.
All right, Jim. And where can we find you?
Oh, as always, jimwatkinsphoto.com. And all the links to all of my social media platforms are right there.
And myself, you can find me at recasper.com. Website just recently went under a renovation of sorts, at least the portfolio side. So if you want to see any of that work, you can head over there. But more importantly, go to streetpx.com. That's where you're going to find the show notes for this particular episode, which is very important because as we've talked about, there are some links out there that you definitely need to take a look at. We'll drop in the Amazon link for his book, but chances are unlikely that it'll be available. But you never know. You might get lucky.
Oh, I'm finding that book, man.
I beat Jim to it because he's already going. But we'll also bring up the stores too that Robert had talked about, and if you really want a copy, you can always contact them and see if you can order that or have that shipped to you. As well as all of our links for our show notes, we also have a lot more episodes that are available. We have blog posts, all that great stuff. But if you want to support us, if you are enjoying Street PX, definitely go take a look at our Patreon. That's patreon.com/StreetPX. And from there, you can find out or you can give a buck, give $5, whatever it is that you feel comfortable with, helps us keep this show as best as we can possibly provide. Beyond just support, you can also buy merchandise. We have t-shirts with about 24 different camera designs, really neat shit that you can show off your film pride right there and say it with your chest. Go give us some reviews on iTunes, stars, gold stars are always currency, yada, 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 all that good stuff. Thank you all for sitting with us and listening in. Thank you, Robert, for joining us here in the interview.
Thank you, gentlemen. Yeah. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, sir.
You're doing an awesome thing for photography, so keep it up.
Oh, man.
We try.
Thank you.
We try. It's just mostly us rambling and bantering on, so we hope that some people out there get some benefit from it.
I sure do, for sure.
Cool.
Good deal. All right, everybody. We will talk to you in 2 weeks. Have a good one.
All right. Take it easy, folks.